According to the clip. Apologies to folks that the room video thing is not working. And so, but I will put this here. And then, is this on the screen? It's not on the screen. Let's see here. Okay. And then let me open up this from last time. Class V2 steering. Okay, cool. So we were almost at the end. We were going through this exercise, and I think this is worthwhile enough that I'll just give you these puzzles to warm up. So we're just continuing on where we left off. I had to apologize for the next professor for making his class late last time. So, but we were going through the weirdness of high dimensions, right? So when you have this idea that a concept is a vector, and the vector is one dimension for every neuron in your system, in your representation, in your neural layer or your whole neural network, then there's tend to be a lot of neurons in modern neural networks. I think that the price for entry now, you're not really talking like a real neural network unless you have like 1,000 neurons or something like that, right? So like 1,000 dimensional is like kind of as small as we get for neural networks that are doing interesting things these days. And so, but 1,000 dimensional geometry is a little different from 3D geometry. So I was asking you to estimate if you make a 3D sphere 1% smaller, then its volume, its radius obviously goes to 99%, right? Its volume, somebody said, goes to 97%, right? It shrinks a little because it's 3D, right? So it shrinks a little faster. But what if you're in 1,000 dimensions and you shrink the ball by 1%? Then how much does the volume shrink by? Well, there's the answer there. It shrinks by all the way down to 0.0004, 0.004%. Really, it's like, it like all the volume goes away. It's crazy, right? Not intuitive. So even worse than that, so you'll sometimes have different ways of sampling numbers. You can sample numbers on a sphere, you can sample numbers in a cube. If you've taken a probability class, they'll say, oh, the uniform distribution, right, which is sort of the equivalent of a cube, just uniformly between 0 and 1, or the Gaussian distribution, which if you generalize that, it's a bell curve, but generalized, it turns into kind of a sphere. So the yeah, what's the difference between uniform and Gaussian? What's the difference between a cube and a sphere? It's like, I don't know. It's like the math often works either way. You could do either way. But what's the difference here? So how much in 3D, how the sphere inside this cube is smaller than the cube? Like how what's the volume of the sphere inside a cube? It's smaller, but by about half, right? 52%. So if you're in 1,000 dimensions, you make a 1,000 dimensional cube, right? What's its area? Well, it's like 1 or 2 to the 1,000, depending on if you include all the octants, but it's like the volume of the cube. So but in 1,000 dimensions, if you inscribe the sphere, then what's the volume of the sphere relative to the cube? Like it's smaller. What's the fraction of the cube that you think is filled by the sphere? Any guesses? 4 divided by 2 minus 1. 4/3 minus 1. So it's like something like or like a third. It's like yeah, it's like maybe it'll be like a third. So instead of a half, maybe it occupies a third. Any other guesses? Well, maybe this number up here, 0.004% or something like that. What do you think? How small do you think the sphere gets? Do you think it's closer to like a third, or do you think it's like 0.004% as a fraction of the cube? Oh, okay. All right. Somebody make a guess. Just I doesn't you're gonna be wrong anyway, because I have a lot of digits here for the correct answer. So you're no way you're gonna be right. Yeah, what do you think? 1 times 10 to the minus 32. That's very small. Should I show you what the answer is? Okay, so about 10 to the minus 32, that's like if like if like one of them is like this big, then this is like smaller than the mass of like an atom or something like that kind of thing, right? And so, okay, let's take a look.
Oh.
You were off by a lot, but you had the right idea. It's 10 to the minus 2,700. Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird? Right? So, yeah, you don't think of these kind of fractions in regular 3D. In regular 3D, right? That is really like it's much like how many atoms do you have in like a cube of sugar or something like that, sugar cube, right? Yeah, 10 to the 24 or something like that. That remember that number from chemistry, right? This is a lot smaller than 10 to the minus 24. This is a lot lighter than one atom, right? It's like way, way smaller. And we haven't really shrunk everything. We've just like gone to the inscribed sphere. So you have to be careful when you're working in large dimensions about your intuition. Like a hypercube, if you happen to have a hypercube, it's all corner. Like you think of the hypercube as evenly split between like its interior and like its corners, right? In a thousand dimension, there is no interior. The amount of interior there is like 10 to the minus 2,700. Okay, there is some. It's not zero. There's some interior, but it's like smaller than the amount of like one atom inside a whole sugar cube. It's like there's basically no interior, right? It's all corner. It's corners everywhere. How many corners do you have? Like 2 to the 1,000 corners, right? You've got like this vast number of corners, and the area, the volume of each corner is like dominates. That makes sense? Right. Okay. So there's also like we use a normal distribution sometimes. And so there's this interesting thing. So like if you take a normal, who knows what the Gaussian normal distribution is, basically, right? Yeah, you've had to deal with this, right? And it's a bell curve. And if you generalize the bell curve to three dimensions, then you get this three-dimensional vector. It's a bell curve in X, a bell curve in Y, a bell curve in Z. And the nice thing, if you do it by X, Y, and Z, it turns out to be this spherical, this spherically symmetric thing. It's this beautiful spherical object. So you can get these nice random vectors with rotationally independent probability distribution by taking these 3D bell curves. And but the thing is, if you take a bell curve, it really looks like this in 3D, right? But if you look at the magnitude of a random vector that you draw from a bell curve, then even though the most likely, the highest density is the vector in the middle, the zero vector, if you look at the magnitude, the most likely magnitude is not zero, right? The most likely magnitude, because if you sort of integrate around all the magnitudes, then the most likely magnitude, it's very unlikely that you have actually a zero magnitude vector. This, like if you take a random draw from a vector of a bell curve, like it's usually around 1.16 or something like that. Like it's going to be kind of it has a magnitude. And so this curve here I've drawn here is not the bell curve. It's what happens if you integrate the bell curve by the magnitude. You sort of go around radially. And you integrate it. And so the average magnitude of something in the Gaussian is here. It's 1.7, 1.6 something, right? That's like the average. That makes sense? In 3D. Anybody taken a physics class, heard of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution? Or chemistry? Yeah, this is what's called the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. It's how they estimate like how many particles in a Gaussian distributed gas have enough energy to overcome the activation barrier, whatever. So they've used this in the past for real life and living in 3D. That's what it's about. Make sense? Okay. So the question is in 1,000 dimensions, you have the same effect, right? Where if you take a random draw in 1,000 dimensions, it's not it's unlikely it's going to be zero. Like what's the average size? So what do you think the average size of a vector is in a thousand-dimensional Gaussian? Any guesses? How would you figure this out? Thousand-dimensional Gaussian, you've got 1,000 numbers, they're randomly plus or minus one, kind of thing, right? And then what's the average like length of that vector?
Yes.
Yeah. Where do you get the 30 from?
So 1.7 looks like square root.
Yeah, square root of 3. Yeah, just okay, good guess. Square root of something. Yeah, that's right. And the square roots show up in statistics. Yeah, so if you take like random numbers plus minus one, and then you take the magnitude of them, then you have to square them, add them all up. If there's 1,000 of them, you're just adding up numbers to 1,000. So then that's like squaring all the numbers gives you about 1,000. But then that's not the size of the vector. The size of the vector is not x a squared plus b squared plus c squared. It's a square root of a squared plus b squared. So you have to take the square root of 3. The square root of 1,000 is around 30 something. Right on, 30. Okay, great. But now the interesting thing though is it's not just exactly 1.7 or exactly 30. There's some like it's gonna be random around it. So what's the variance, right? What's the standard deviation around this? So in 3D, the standard deviation is around 40%. So it's like 1.7 plus or minus 40%, right? It's how big these vectors are when you draw them from random Gaussian. So what do you think the variance is when you draw from a thousand-dimensional Gaussian? I'll give you a hint. That's the picture. That's what it looks like over there. See that picture? See it, that picture goes up to 31.6, and the variance is around 3%. Right? So it's like it's around 30, and then sort of only plus or minus like one. It's like in this really, really narrow range. So if you like draw a random vector from a Gaussian and the magnitude is not around 31, it's not 30 to 32 or something like that, then you'd be like, what the heck? How did I draw this thing from this random Gaussian and the magnitude is like 10 in 1,000 dimensions? That basically never happens. That's like one of those 10 to the minus 2700 kind of like events. It's like, oh, I'm in like the middle of the sphere when I should be not, right? It doesn't happen. There's no volume in there. Does that make sense? That weird? It's weird. It's very weird. So they call this the soap bubble phenomenon. When you like draw a random Gaussian in high dimensions, that distribution actually, the best intuition is like a very thin shell. It's like the soap bubble. So high dimensions are very weird. The geometry in high dimensions is very weird. There's a lot of counterintuitive stuff. So all the stuff that we were talking about last time about you can fit a lot of stuff into the vector space, a lot of these phenomena are magnified in high dimensions. And so when people have these intuitions, like you can only think about, if you had 1,000 neurons, you can really only think about 1,000 independent things. But maybe you can relax that by a little bit. Like, what if you said, oh, you know, we're willing to withstand like 1% error. We're going to relax it. Then it might help by a little bit. And your intuition might be, oh, if you accept 1% error, it helps by like 1%. But actually, for a different phenomenon, if you like accept 1% error, it might help exponentially. It might like increase the space that you have to work with by thousands and thousands, right? And so this is one of the things that, you know, it leads to counterintuitive things. It's just the facts of high-dimensional geometry, and we're still working through this as a field, trying to build these intuitions. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about is binding. There's this why binding is hard. So I mentioned this thing before, the idea that you can think about a horse, and you might have a horse vector. Oh, there's a horse in this picture. See this horse? Look at that horse. See that horse? And if horse is good friends with that cat, so you might have another concept of a cat. And then when you see this picture, both of those, you know, vectors light up in your head. You can think about a horse and a cat at the same time by just like maybe by kind of adding your representation vectors, right? That's kind of the model people have had for, you know, how a concept vector might work. But in real life, you have these other concepts that you have to deal with, and you've got these binding things, and this is one of the classic mysteries of how neural networks works. How do they represent binding? Because in this picture, the interesting thing is not that I just have a horse and a cat. This horse is wearing a fedora, right? And the cat is wearing like a nice knit cap. We like these knit caps, and so, you know, somehow we want to remember that horse and fedora are associated. So if these were all vectors, then you've got horse maybe plus fedora is like the thing that we're thinking. I mean, cat plus cap is the thing we're thinking. But can that possibly be true? Because if that's how we think of it, then, you know, it doesn't work because it's indistinguishable from what? What's it indistinguishable from? Say louder, louder.
What's putting in a cat man and cat making for the
Like that? Yeah, Gemini is great. You can ask her, you can switch your hats around. It's indistinguishable from this, right? And so basically there's this this classic papers from 1990 where they're like, this is basically the situation. You could have a horse, you have a cat, you have fedora, you have a cap, and you could imagine like representing all these as a vector, each one of these things is a separate vector and adding them together, but this doesn't solve the problem. And so what Smolensky wrote in 1990 is that, well, maybe if you want to really solve this problem, then you need a lot more dimensions or neurons or whatever. But like, yeah, so you need a lot more dimensions. How many dimensions do you need? You need kind of like this many dimensions, right? If you needed this many dimensions, if you needed, five dimensions to represent the hats and four dimensions to represent the animals, then maybe you need four times five dimensions to represent all the bindings between them. And now I can represent the cat is wearing the cap and the horse is wearing the fedora by like lighting up those dimensions. And there's enough space in this product space, in this tensor product space, to represent like, oh, these two things are happening at the same time without getting them confused. Does that make sense? So that's what they proposed in the 1990s. And then other people basically looked at this and they said, "Ah, that's why neural networks could never work. Because there's a lot of things going on in the world with lots of bindings. As soon as you try to generalize this to triple bindings and more people in the room and more things that are going on and more complicated structure, and if you keep on having to multiply the dimension like this, like how many neurons are you going to need? Like, 25, 30 neurons seems fine, but if we keep on multiplying numbers, then soon we're going to need more neurons than there are atoms in the universe. Like you're never going to solve the problem. What are you going to do, right?" And so this was one of the main arguments against connectionism, that like this can't possibly be how thinking actually works. Now, and it remains one of the mysteries. How does binding work, right? That makes sense. And so now, but the systems can do binding, they can do things like this. And so the question is how do they do it? Are they burning all these dimensions or what are they doing? And this is still open science. And but I, so I'm sort of just exposing you to the historical literature and where we are in it. But Nikhil is probably the world's expert on binding in large language models. I'd say that the research program is in progress, so we don't have answers to all these things yet. But you can always ask him what's up if you encounter a binding problem in your research projects. Okay, so that's binding. Any questions on this? So we had a couple people. Oh, Eunice had a question. Ayush had a question that I thought was relevant to this. Yes.
Yeah, when I'm reading the concepts are probably Vector's paper, they basically argue that LLMs who prove that the connectionist program, arguing that the all of what's happening in our brain is all about connections, will be proven.
Yes.
So
And so doesn't it doesn't the whole isn't that true? Doesn't the LLM existence of LLMs vindicate? Yeah, let me come back to that. I'll answer to you in a second. And then Ayush also had a question. What was Ayush's question? Yes.
let's say, how do you determine that the embedding was of Fedora?
Yes.
Why couldn't it be of just something green or like something on top of I? How do you determine that this embedding is particular to this also?
Oh yeah, so I think that a lot of this is predicated on. So a lot of these old arguments are thought experiments, not empirical experiments. They're asking, well, let's say there was some vector that has to do with Fedora. Now we are living in a different era now. We're living with these actual neural networks, where you can directly probe the models to see when you show them a hat, what is the vector response? And so most of what you guys would be doing in this class is actually doing that, is actually collecting those data, that data, and trying to make sense of it. So I'm mostly in this background class, I'm giving you the historical background for what people theorized about it. So Smolensky and folks, they didn't have an answer for how you would know this is a vector for green and this is a vector for hat or anything. They just said, well, what if there was a vector for hat? What if there was a vector? And then how would you reason about that, right? So for answers for what would it be a good vector for hat, we've already seen a couple tools. So I don't know if you had a chance to play with Neuronpedia. You should. So I want everybody to actually like do the notebook that we had. We just didn't have time to do it in class. But there's these great tools that people have for trying to label vectors in representation space. And so I'll bring up Neuronpedia. And let's see if we can do one or two. So Neuronpedia. Okay, so Neuronpedia. Let's jump to, we'll do a search or something like this. Let's jump to a model. Yeah. Oh, is it not showing? Did it give up? What happened? What happened to HDMI? What happened? It's just HDMI. It's just hardware. What?
You have to bring the, you have to drag it on top.
Give me a second. Screen mirroring. It's supposed to be screen mirroring. No, I have no place to drag it. I only have one screen. What? Is it because, oh. Hey, wait, let me stop this projection. So wait. Wait. Stop. Why is it? So it's impossible for me to manipulate Neuronpedia if I can't see it on my own screen. If that makes any sense, have you ever tried? Like, you can't do that. Like, I need to mirror. But then if I say screen mirroring here, display settings, arrange, is there a way to mirror this? Do you see what I'm, you don't see what I'm doing. So nobody can give me advice. Let's see here. Use as main display, mirror. All right.
That's your other screen.
Oh, now it's alive. Okay. Who knows how these things work? It's very expensive and doesn't do what I want. Yeah. So, let's see. So let's say, let's like horse. Okay. Let's see how this model thinks of horse, right? And so what you see here is, what this is it's a database of vector representations inside a language model, trying to see where it's thinking about horses. And there are many, many different vectors that seem to light up whenever you mention mules and horses and horse racing. And here's a different vector that lights up whenever you're talking about riding horseback or riding on horses, which is a little different from thinking about just the fact of a horse and things like that. And so each one of these little boxes corresponds to a vector. And there's a little library that you can use called SAE Lens that is meant, used in the notebook that after you play with this Neuronpedia and you use it as like a little search engine to find vectors and things like this, you can actually get the physical vector, like the physical list of 768 numbers or something that this was. Does that make sense?
Why so many representations for horse?
Why are there so many? So the way that this was found was, so they the research technique that they used to get these vectors was to train an autoencoder, a sparse autoencoder, which is like the compressed coding exercise that I showed you last class, but in reverse. So in the last class, I said, what if you had 20 animals and you only have five neurons to represent them? Well, what if you were in the opposite situation? What if somebody gave you the five neural signals and asked you, what do you think the 20 underlying, true signals are? And we don't have a good way of figuring that out that is provable, but a reasonable approach is to train a neural network that does the opposite, that takes five as input, and then in the hidden middle layer, blows it out to 20, and then tries to reconstruct the five again, right? So it's just the opposite neural network shape that you know we talked about last time. And so people go around and they try to train these, and then they say, okay, well, look, we think we have 1,000 dimensions, we have 700 dimensions in this model, and we think that there might be a million concepts encoded in these 700 dimensions. So why don't we just train a million dimensional sparse autoencoder to see what vectors seem to, you know, line up with this space? And then once you have these million vectors that seem to encode something that's interesting and sparse in this representation, then they say, well, what are these vectors? And they what they do is they go to all this text and they say, when does this vector light up? Right? And these vectors light up on horse-related things. So, but there's more than one. There's a whole bunch of different vectors that they found that all light up on horse-related things. And so that's what you get. Does that make sense? So that's physically what it is. We can talk more about sparse autoencoders later. They're really expensive to train, so I'm not encouraging you guys to train sparse autoencoders and stuff in this class, but you know, you can read about them if you, there's plenty to read about them. But we're going to be doing more hypothesis-driven research. So you can use pre-trained sparse autoencoders that other people have done to get a sampling of vectors to get a sense for what's going on. But if you want to find individual vectors, then I'll encourage you to just set up your own optimizer and like look for one vector at a time, that kind of thing, instead of trying to do an unsupervised process and find a million. Okay. Yeah, at least that's the what we're going to be doing in this class. Okay, so that so but you should but like other people have trained these things to try to find and label like a million vectors at a time. And that's what Neuronpedia is all about. I encourage you guys to use it in your projects, to at least build intuition, or at least to, you know, try to get a sense for what's in the vector space that's related to your topic. Yeah, so there's other ways of using this. You can run the text and so on. And there's a few examples in the notebook. And if you want to use your project presentation time to you know, present like what's not working for me or share your experiences using it, then you should do that. Okay. Okay. So that's what that's about. I'm still mirroring, right? So I think that's it. So what else do we want to talk about? So that's it. So then the last paper was a steering paper, and there were a couple papers there. Oh, so the oh, you, your question I put off. What was your question again? Your question was,
I mean, so they argue
oh, it
that.
doesn't vindicate. Yes, I'll address this. I love this question. I think it vindicates it. I think, you know, the folks that won the Turing Award and the Nobel Prize think it vindicates it. So basically, you know, there's this question, you know, is this old, you know, like you have this binding problem and you have all these other puzzles, but this, like, to me, this is like the core puzzle. This is what the old linguists like Chomsky, you know, Chomsky like points at this research and says, you will never solve it. You'll never really think, right? It doesn't matter how big the neural network is, because I can give you more complicated puzzles to solve, more complicated logical reasoning to string together, and your neural network will never be able to think about these things. But people can somehow. We're doing something different. This is not how neural net, you know, this is not how it works. But I think that they're wrong. I think the LLMs have proven they can win like these math competitions and stuff. They can think about very complicated compositions, and they can do variable binding. They can do theory of mind, right? You know, at least that's what we're finding, right, Nikhil, in your research. And they have reasonable algorithms inside to try to do this. And so I think that the answer is yes. The existence of LLMs to most people obviously vindicate the connectionists, obviously. And yet, if we invited Gary Marcus, right, or to I don't know, cross the river and join us here, he would say, David, what are you teaching these impressionable young minds? The question is not settled. It's far from settled. We are nowhere close to AGI. All you're seeing is the capacity of these things to memorize. They are good pattern matchers, and they're just memorizing stuff they've seen. They have a big memory. You've exposed them to lots of text. And they're just regurgitating stories they've seen. They can do theory of mind, they can do math problems, but they've seen these theory of mind puzzles before, and they're just rewording it and doing something shallow and regurgitating the answer again. They've seen this math before. You might think that they haven't seen it, but you've exposed them to so much text. They're just repeating what they've seen. They're not really thinking about it, right? They can't be, because if they were, you would run out of dimensions. There's no way. They're very secure in their reasoning, right? You would need more neurons than atoms in the universe to solve this problem, right? Now, the Piantedosi paper says, oh no, but there are solutions here. Like, there's these VSA people who the theorists who say, if you're willing to accept some error, then you can do a lot more in here. Now, these are all pre-empirical. This is all pre-LLM, all this theory. And so now we are in this domain where LLMs can apparently do this stuff, but we don't know what encodings they actually use. And so, this is some of what we're here to find out. Make sense? Yeah. So, okay. So that's my answer. I think it's obvious that they're vindicated. Yeah, these LLMs, they can help me write grant proposals and stuff. It's pretty good. They can think, right?
But still, we don't know too much about human cognition.
Yeah, but we don't really know how thinking
Because
works.
they use framing. I look at LLMs solve the composition of the problem, and then they know better about human cognition
Yes.
compared to the past.
Yes.
I'm kind of questioning that claim. So yes, LLMs solve the composition of the problem, and then through that connectionist program is kind of rigorous and then promising, but still we don't know too much
We don't know
about
how people think, but I do think it gives us a view on it, right? It gives us what a learnable algorithm might do. We're able to learn this thinking, and so yeah, the interesting thing about the neural networks, not only that they work, but somehow they're trainable, that they can actually emerge. And so now we have the same property. So maybe there's something to learn about humans. I think there is something to learn. I just wanted to give a sense. I'm not going to talk about this paper much. It's a steering paper. The idea is that you can collect behavior from models in two different situations when they are, acting correctly or truthfully or honestly, and other situations where they're getting fooled or they're giving the wrong answer, the dishonest answer for some things. Truthful QA is a whole database of commonly stated misinformation facts. And so, you can the models can either be fooled by the disinformation fact, or they can refute it. And the interesting thing is, when you go through the neurons and you see how is a model activating its neurons in these two different situations, what Kenneth found was the clear signal was in these attention head neurons when he was looking at it, or these attention head vectors, and that you can see a slight difference between how it's behaving when it's sticking up for the truth and when it's falling victim to misinformation. And then if he applies the still if he steers the neural network to add this vector while it's thinking, then he can steer the network to stick up for the truth more often. And so this is called a steering vector. You observe like the difference between the way the network works in two different situations. You take that vector difference. So he had a really small vector difference, right? And then you apply that vector difference on purpose while you're running the network in inference to get it to change its behavior. And so his paper is all about achieving, showing that you can achieve this in some small scenario, over a few thousand questions. And so that's what that paper is about. So one of the early steering papers. So what were the questions about this? Claire and Ananyan had a question about belief versus output. Where's Claire? Where's Ananya? Yes, Claire.
I honestly don't remember my question, but I think it had something to do with the fact that the truthful and false activations were so like deeply overlapping.
Yes, like this kind of picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I didn't really believe that the output like was being truthful, and especially since like I remember now, it's like it's just following the pattern.
Yeah.
Maybe it was like fit to the data set.
I think it's a very reasonable question. It was really a toy setup. I forget how big Truthful QA is. It's some number of thousands of questions. And, Kenneth did the right thing. He split this data set into a test and training set so that he collected these vectors using some of the questions, and then he tested down the other questions to test if it generalizes. So he did find something that generalized. He found like a truth direction that if he steered the models, then on unseen questions, it behaved better. But it's true, it's like a really small data set. It's not like some profound, finding of truth across, real organic use. It's more of a proof of concept, right? So I think that's a valid question. Did Ananya have a re related question to this? Is Ananya here?
So I again forgot my question was, but I think it was like, what if the model, like, I think the paper was trying to steer towards the truthful direction that's by human labels, or like that was the ground truth.
Yeah, that's right. That's a ground truth, yes.
But how did, like, I think they calculated some accuracy or something for, like, how does the model know that's the ground truth? Or I don't remember. And
Right. There's also another kind of question. It's like, oh, did the model already know this and you're just exposing it? I think that maybe that was your question. Yeah, that has the vibe of a lot of, a lot of machine learning work now. Is it like, oh, there's a lot of situations where you feel like, oh, the models actually know the difference between these different things, and you're just sort of steering it one way or the other. Like, steering is not really training. Like, we're not teaching the model anything new. It's just like one vector, right? Like, what can it get from one vector? We're just like pushing the model to expose some behavior that it already has somewhere inside it. Like, it knows what the category is for all of these questions, and it knows what like the right answer would be, and but it doesn't choose to utter the right answer some of the time because of whatever reason. But if you nudge it this way, then it'll answer the right way more frequently. So it's like a mode of operation that's already present in the network, and you're just like sort of steering and exposing it. And so you get that feeling a lot in this type of work. And so which I think it's which is cool, right? There's how about Yichan, hallucination versus lying, you had a question?
So, don't think this paper deal with hallucination. There was like a homicide of the inside activities of brain. And what if like the model they think that they're speaking the truth, but they're actually not like, but. How to say, like, what if they feel like, what if they believe what if they're saying is true, but in their knowledge base, they have some knowledge in conflict. Like, how do we deal with things like that?
Yeah, or I like the way that I think that I remember the sentence, the question that you submitted also, which is sort of like, what's the difference between a model like making a mistake, maybe because it has a conflict or something like that, and really lying, like really like telling a lie? Is there a difference between these things? And I think there is, but I think that you like when you state it that way, it sounds to me like another open research question, right? So we have. Like in machine learning, we're accustomed to trying to reduce the error rate of our systems. As computer scientists, we just try to make them more reliable, make them more accurate. And so there's not, we haven't confronted the question of lying, really. We've just been trying to get our systems to be more accurate, right? But there is this, so, but when you play with the systems and you say, well, if you say it like that, then I'll change my answer, right? Which is kind of the feeling you get when you steer these systems sometimes, right? Then you start worrying, is it telling me the truth, or is it tailoring its behavior to sort of lie to me to make me happy, right? Don't you get that feeling a lot with when you're interacting with the large systems? Like you feel like you might be surrounded by deception all over the place. And I think that has not been really crisply stated or studied in the literature. So I think that that's like it's a really nice question, right? How do we know if the models are sort of lying to us in some way, right? Yeah, and which is different from like some random error. It's not like they were incompetent, and out of incompetence they couldn't get the right answer. It's almost like they're hyper competent. It's like, oh, they know who's asking them the question, and I'm going to tailor that for you. I'm gonna, you know what I mean? Oh, yeah, you're a, you're an anti-vax person. So I guess the way I'll say it is this, right? Or whatever, right? It's kind of an interesting question. Okay. So yeah, so go ask the models of what do they think of Roundup and glyphosate, right? And take a couple different perspectives on that. See if you can get it to answer different ways. That might be a good research question. Okay. So, there's more. Sorry. Grace and Armita. Okay, Grace.
The tricky way is that common misconceptions among people
Common misconceptions.
that like a language model would want to model common misconceptions.
Yes, that's right.
And also a helpful language model, you know, if I say, you know, oh, why did Santa not give me as many presents as last year? You know, I don't want the model saying, you know, actually Santa Claus is not real and it's about, you know, like there's like many different instances where you don't want
Well, you don't want to say the truth. Yeah.
so I'm just curious, like yeah, this seems like a interesting feature. It's like common misconceptions often have common true things that would be encoded.
Right.
So this is
So this is like
looking
maybe
at it.
revealing a vector, which is the difference between a common misconception and the common correction. And the model knows both of these things. And it looks like Kenneth has like found a way of kicking the model off of one of these behaviors and kicking it over to the other thing that it knows, right? Does that make sense to you? So Grace is familiar with this data set. And so, but does that make so this data set is, yeah, it's common misconceptions, I think, mined from things that people often say on Reddit or whatever that are not true. And you know, that's what this data set is. Yeah.
Way to find the truth is to say something wrong on the internet. So I'm guessing every time someone said this wrong, there's always some other Reddit comment where someone's like, actually, did you know it's
Yeah.
actually
Yeah.
so.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, I think that's right. And it might reduce the scope of how relevant this is to more difficult domains. But okay, I'm going to go to the next question. Armita, last question.
When people work with the output, it depends on the prompt item. And how can we distinguish the prompts and the like internal component, the model that's giving us this output? Paper said, I think ITIN prompting is orthogonal, something like that, and it
Yes. It's interesting. So first of all, I think that they're using orthogonal not as a technical term, just as a informal term to say that the effects that they get from changing the prompt and the effects that they get from steering in their example are additive. They're not like if they had the same mode of operation, then you might expect that once you did some steering, that changing the prompt wouldn't help. So what they're saying is, if you ask the model, if you ask the model, hey, is this true or not? Some fact about, some common misconception, is this true or not? The model might give you the false fact. But if you change a prompt and you say, I'm writing a book about correcting common misconceptions, and I would like you to help me write an answer to whether this is true or not. If you like tailor a prompt like that, then you might get it to be more accurate. That makes sense. And then the question that they had was, okay, well, we found the steering vector that also gets the model to be more accurate if we just nudge all the neurons. Did we rediscover what the model is doing to itself when you prompt it in this way to make it more accurate? And they said, no, what we found was orthogonal. In other words, if you prompt it then it makes it more correct. But then if in addition you also steer it, then it makes it even more correct. It's not redundant, right? That makes sense. And so I think they're talking about orthogonality in this informal sense, but that's what they mean. But they didn't, I don't think they shared a lot of data about what they found there. They didn't run a formal experiment. I think they just mentioned this in passing. So we have to trust Kenneth that that he did this. I think it is, I do think it's an interesting question. Right. Yeah. Okay, so let's do team E. I'm gonna switch over to the presentations, and you guys can share what you've done for your, your project assignment for this week, and we can discuss the projects. Team E first. Team E, is Team E ready? Okay, let's go. What'd you say? Okay, yeah. Sorry, we ran too long. But we'll do what you can. Okay. So we have an HDMI here for you guys. And then okay, so let's come up with an ordering. So let's do team E, and then we'll do teams that also got short shrift last time. So let's do the spatial team after team E, and then after the spatial team, who also were those the two teams that got stuck last time going over? Who are the ones that went over? Okay, then okay, after team E, we'll do spatial, then the mapping team, then the TK team, then gosh, let's come up with an ordering. Nikhil, can you help me?
Yeah. Okay, I can't wait with you. Yeah. So we can go. What was PK? What was PK?
PK is a journalism team. TJ.
We have political bias function about.
Yeah. So last time I was first from the blue lines.
Okay. So
and
then
then
the political
political
bias.
is second. You want to say the last. Wait.
It's
Is it working?
yeah.
And great. So let me stop sharing here. And I'll turn on this camera for the Zoom so they can see you, whoever's from remote. Okay, so the floor is yours. Okay.
So we took a different aspect into trying to identify concepts of uncertainty and specifically economic uncertainty in large language models. I did some experiments on steering because I found that very interesting. I worked on Gemma 290, and I could not locate any exact term for economic uncertainty. I could only locate the terms for uncertainty generally. So there are a few interesting things. Uncertainty late at layer 31 changed what was predicted from specific details, like it would say 7% without the steering and X percent with the steering. So it's pretty interesting. But inserting at layers 9 and 20 actually had the model generate earnings call with hints towards economic uncertainty. And I will go ahead and show those off.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Can you make that bigger?
No.
No. Let's go. Wait. Yeah, but they do that too. Do both of them. Expand this. Okay, this is great. Better?
Yeah, I believe this is layer 9.
So, what did you write at the top?
Write a snippet of an earnings call
Oh.
that focuses on future predictions.
I see. So, you're doing this generation.
Yeah. And so over here, there's a lot of like very certain, like, we're going to do a lot of great things. We're going to do really well. We're going to strengthen the customer relationships, expand into new markets. And then over here, it's like, oh God, everything is terrible. There's inflation, there's geopolitical tension, there's consumer co sentiment remains fragile, it says. So steering very early on makes it super uncertain. And then
When you say early on, what do you mean by early on?
Like layer nine, this is layer nine, so early on in the
Layer
attention
nine.
lanes.
Okay.
Then for layer 20, it's a little bit, I had to play around with the prompt a little bit to give me what I wanted, but you can see that it gives me two examples of an earnings call, and the one with steering has a lot more like positive vibes to it, while the, sorry, the one without steering has more positive vibes to it, while the one that was steered towards uncertainty literally says his event answer avoids giving a definitive prediction, even though I asked it to give predictions about the future. It's like, I can't do that. So that was kind of interesting.
That's right.
And then finally, this is the interesting case that I found. If you see here, we project a 7% decrease versus over here, we project a decline of X percent in revenue.
Well, you'd have to say X instead of seven.
Yeah. So that's what happened when I steered uncertainty at layer 31, which I thought was pretty interesting. It seems like I couldn't find economic uncertainty, but definitely steering in layers 9 and 20 made it to like sort of adjust to the economic uncertainty, especially focusing on geopolitics, the like modern activities that are causing so much an economic
So
uncertainty.
you have this confounder, right? Don't you have so there's optimists. So you made this nice distinction in your pitch. There's this distinction between like optimism and pessimism and uncertainty, right? And so when you're steering with uncertainty, it sort of makes the model more pessimistic. It's like, oh, things are not as good and stuff like that. But then once in a while you also see these signs that it's like more uncertain. Like, I wonder if there's some way to separate those. Anyway, I think it's interesting. It's like this confounder, right? You know what I mean?
Veronica might be able to better specify this, but how I interpret economic uncertainty is that it implies negative economic behavior
It's tied to it.
overall, because otherwise economics is this like what we said virtuous cycle where like positive belief reinforces itself and negative belief reinforces itself. That's not true.
So I guess the question I have, so okay, do you have more slides?
Yes.
Okay, to my point.
Besides like that kind of generation and steering, examining steering effects, we also tried to target that particular feature and see like, given a snippet of earnings calls, where that feature activates on. So we play around with this particular feature. So the LLM generated explanation says it's terms related to economic conditions and financial implications. But like when we look into that feature and see like where it gets activates on, presumably on the training corpus of the SE, it always activate on like US-China tensions, weakening economic growth and higher output from rivals, et cetera, et cetera. So like it sort of fits in our definition of uncertainty. Though I think again, regarding the distinguish between first and second moment, this feature doesn't do a great job on that. It sort of like correlates sentiment with uncertainty, but as this preliminary analysis, so like for example, it also boosts like logics of Brexit, which like is also like one literature we looked at last time. So we think this feature might be interesting, and Veronica, who unfortunately cannot be here, actually manually labeled a bunch of texts. And sort of like classify those into like low, mid, and high uncertainty. And we kind of want to learn how that feature activates on like those different levels of uncertainty tags. And we found that it is actually doing a pretty good job. So like this is the low uncertainty case. And I'm going to a high uncertainty. So like this text is like is representing a high uncertainty, like, but the backdrop is also important. Timeables are different. Geopolitical is an enormous amount of risk. And here's like its activation patterns, which shows like a clear difference from the low uncertainty case. And we also tested like a bunch of earnings calls snippets. And I think so it mostly aligns with our judgments of uncertainty to a certain degree, but like it also activates on like a bunch of seemingly random tokens. So it might mean that they are a little bit noisy. So we were just wondering if like we could do some thresholding as like a immediate next step.
Great. In contrast, we also directly interact with the gamma 9b models. So, given the prompt here, all I have to do is to put that examples as an input to make it define the uncertainty score, which is from 0 to 1, and also the results and the evidence, like why it given that score as well. So we have that, which is like a Veronica's data set. So as you can see, there are labels, three labels. So as you can see here, I think the score is pretty nice, which means the model can distinguish from different
Okay,
uncertainty
so actually
levels.
back up. So what is it that you did here? So you separated text into three sets or something like that, or what kind of?
Let me explain. So Veronica write these data set and label with different uncertainty
Yes,
levels.
just like the last one.
or
Low,
intermediate or high.
intermediate,
Yeah,
yes.
great. So you have these pieces of text.
Yes. Yeah.
And then what are you measuring the mean and standard deviation of?
So the uncertainty score is from 0 to 1. So in my prompt is like my suggestion would be like if you think it's like a low uncertainty, then you should provide score from 0.0 to 0.3. From if it's a medium, provide from 0.3 to
Oh, so you're just
0.7.
asking the model
Yeah, it's
to.
like a prompt engineering.
Yeah, got
If
it.
you are directly interact with them.
Yes.
Yeah. So but surprisingly, direct model prediction seem to be very conservative. There's no false positive examples. Excellent. These two samples are directly the same as Rice just presented. So as you can see here, this is the low uncertainty example. The score is like 0.3, which is relatively low. They also provide the evidence from the which is a little bit similar with the highlighted green part in the sample subset. So the high uncertainty samples are actually quite similar as well. But we find one negative example, which is the apple. It is in the high uncertainty part, but it's only gave the 0.3 uncertainty scores. Yeah. I think that will be all.
That makes sense. And what size generally were you playing with?
Also, in IB, we use this exactly same model in
I see.
all the experiments,
I
right?
see. That makes sense. So, yeah. So you're sort of in this interesting phase where you're trying to figure out what you're going to do for your real experiments. Like you haven't started your real experiments yet. You're just like
Yeah, just
scooping around, looking at things, which is okay. So my encouragement would be to goof around more broadly. Like right now you're like, okay, we're pretty proud of like we use Gemini B for everything because we're being scientific about it. It's like almost too early to be so scientific, right? I'd be curious about some things, even if it was only quantitative anecdotal evidence. Like you have this nice accuracy where you said, oh, we tested a few times and the model was not capable of, it gave us a false negative here. It thought they weren't uncertain when they actually were. Is that different for a different model? Like if you used a bigger model, if you use like one of the 30B models or something like that, right? Like would it actually be more accurate? Would it behave different? Like how do different models behave? You played with a few things, which is good. I like how on one side you're really in the generation side. And the other side, you're looking at like this classification problem. So I guess my real question is, do either of these feel like a promising domain to study where you're like, oh yeah, this is actually would be interesting to people, that would be relevant. Like I suspect that when you're done with your project, it probably won't be both about generation and classification. You'll probably like pick one of them, right, to mainly focus on. But I don't know if you have any takeaways yet about whether one of them seem
I
different
think
or more interesting.
people are using it more on the classification side, so like the economists. And for example, they've already tried to use it to come up with some sort of like uncertainty indices,
Nice.
using, I think they fine-tune it. But like basically, for example, from this result, we can try to see like what's really going on here. Like, how does the model come up with the number 0.7 or like from its internals probably, but like we could definitely do some more
That makes
exploratory
sense.
analysis.
So now you have these nice S&E vectors and things like that. And so like I wonder whether those vectors for uncertainty are lighting up here at all,
Yeah.
or if it's interrelated. So you can try to pass some of these things here. That's my main feedback. But okay, so that's me. Sorry. Anybody else have suggestions for this team? Any questions or ideas for them to try?
I mean, I think similar to what David said, maybe try different models. Try to see if behaviorally if you see any significant difference. I think I remember last time I said that maybe try some model from DeepSeek or some other Chinese company and maybe try to compare it with them or of the American ones and see if behaviorally, at least for this classification task, there is a significant difference. That is something, if there is a significant difference, that is something.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Kimi. What's the next thing that we have?
F.
Yes. All right, you guys. Oh, we should have people queue up faster because we're like, they're running out of time. Okay.
Okay, so this is our update, and we mainly focus on the logic lens, and because the package we use for the example in Colab doesn't work for vision language model, so we implement the logic lens by ourselves, and we get different results from them. And the first thing we do is we choose different models and based on the suggestion we receive from our pitch. And this one is Llama 3.2 vision. It's built on Llama 3.1 text only model. And also we choose another model from Chinese company Qianwen 3, and it's built based on Qianwen 3 LM. And also there is another one, also built on Tianwen 3 LM, but they use a different training strategy. So I think this is a good way to compare that different training strategy or different visual encoder impact on the reasoning process. So this is the experiment on Llama, and so the setting is here is we use the in context learning, and we first define the task is to classifier safe or unsafe and answer with just one word. And also there is a example here with the first image, and the label is safe, and we want to know like the model's judgment for the second image. And here's the result. Yeah, I cannot show on this. But the problem is in the middle layer, the probability of all token is close to zero. So, and only the final layer shows some probability of different tokens. So,
The problem maybe is because the implementation is not works that much, or for this model, it just like make the decision in the final layer, and here is something related to the image and cannot interpret by the text. So we still don't know, and we will figure it out later. And for the last token, here is the answer of like the probability of two answers, and we can see that model think this image is safe, but for me, I don't think so because it's like in the middle of the street and there are a lot of vehicle there. So here is another interesting thing. I changed the example. I changed the label of this example from safe to unsafe. And I want to see that it changed the probability for model prediction. And I see that it changed a lot, like 10% increase. So that means the model consider more on this example. That doesn't make sense. So it's an interesting problems we may think about in the future, like how the example, how the text, how the prompt affect the final judgment.
Yeah, I guess we also do some scoring tests. For example, we have this prompt. Given a picture of a street view, to let the model rate a score from 0 to 10, and we pick these two are QN and the bottom two are InternVL. So you can see that they have a very similar output based on their judgment on the same street view image. And the only difference is that the second example, they only differ by one. And,
What's every row and every column of this
oh, so it's actually the row is the last five tokens I visualized, and the column is just the number of layers. Yeah, so we can see that approximately to the last few layers, they have finalized the answer.
Wait, I don't understand. This is a picture of the transformer
Right,
by that many layers. And then how do you get the? I'm sorry. Is this logic? This is not logic lens. This
This
is
log
something else.
lens.
Is this probing or what is this?
It's probability and the
What is what?
it is probability
Oh, probability.
and
Where do you
the
get the probability
predict
from?
token. I'm sorry?
Where do you get the probability?
From I mean from the decoder.
Oh,
Like
so it is logic lens.
logic, yeah.
So using the decoder to get it. Oh, I see. And green means high?
Where's my height? Yeah,
And
that
then, and which token is high for green?
So actually for this one, this is safer and convert to score at the end.
I see. So, but like the word safe.
Yeah, safe, yeah.
Oh, I see. So it looks like logic lens is kind of working here, but it looks like logic is it just a different implementation
Oh,
or what?
it's the model. I mean, these are based on QN and InternVL, and the previous one is based on Llama.
Oh, it's a different model.
Yeah.
Oh, which one is this?
QN.
Oh,
So
I
the
see.
top rows are QN and the bottom rows are InternVL.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. So logic lens might be non-zero for this one.
And we for the experiment doing experiment out about let the model compare two scenarios and to make a judgment call which one is safer, and we can see the similar results as the previous thing.
Here are some takeaways, like just like what we mentioned before, the logical lens may be not work for Llama, but maybe it's because the implementation problem, so I will check it later. The example provided for in the prompt may affect a lot for the final decision. And this.
Yeah, and we also see that the scoring and comparison judgment are, their answers are constructed later in the networks.
In the last few layers.
Yeah, last few layers, yeah.
That's it. Like we don't do a lot for this week because we
No, it's
want to.
great. You guys aren't, this expectation is not that you're gonna go win the Nobel Prize in 1 week. It's okay. We're just trying, we're sharing, We're all, I feel like we're all learning these methods, and the methods themselves are immature. We're kind of just gathering information and sharing it. So I thank you guys, and you know, thanks for all the things for sharing. Do people have any questions or suggestions for the team? For anything like that? And,
yeah, this, can we go back to the HTML pictures?
The which one?
To the actual images you're getting. Is there any way for the model that the model might know where those are?
Yeah, they have the coordinates and the city information and even time of day.
Okay, because I wonder if, like, you're talking about how it seems weird that the label isn't lining up with your perception. Like, is there some way to figure out if the model's incorporating that information about where this is, what's the city, what's the street address, and that
Sure.
information that's not in the image itself, but the kind of like metadata around the image into the prediction? Because, like, when you were saying the label wasn't lining up with the perception, but I agree with that, it made me think about, like, what else the model might be picking up on that's not in the image. They're making that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we can include those information for the experiments to see is it different from the results we have now.
Yeah, like if you give that same image but like change the metadata, maybe, like maybe it will end up coming up with a different
I see.
prediction.
That's totally my favorite experiment that you did. You're like, oh, we'll do exactly the same thing. We'll just change one little thing in the prompt. And then you're like, oh, it's different. Now, as soon as you start comparing things where you're like controlling a variable, you know, now that's a scientific experiment, right? And so, you know, if metadata can be presented or withheld for the model, you can see if that changes. But what other, you can also think about what other variables you might want to present or withhold or change that are interesting to you. And we're still like probing around to see like what's feasible and what's interesting. And so when you said, oh, we found that it was interesting to do that, I wonder if did other people think that was interesting? That the thing that they found that is like prompt sensitive in this way? Any other suggestions on like how to make it even more interesting?
I think maybe we should define what is safe and what is unsafe.
Yeah.
Give some
Tell them.
I mean when I use the judger, I need to give some metrics like what is safe, what is unsafe, and that will help the judger to make the decision. For example, here maybe the judger think if there is a gun, it is unsafe. Then there's no gun, then it's safe.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you're saying that we need to like prompt it into the React to see how they're going to understand the concept though that will give the correspondent result.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh,
I think
yeah,
that's what I
exactly.
heard.
I also think that's like literature or instruction hierarchy. So the example is one part of the instruction is a system prompt that you're giving. For example, if you define that, it will be like the user prompt. So you could maybe like look, I don't know, I have a lot of like background on that, but you can see like what part of like is the, in this case is the model like giving more attention to the example, and if you can modulate that.
Sorry, is like the attention, for example, like
It's called instruction hierarchy, where like the model basically the model gives different amount of importance to different parts of the instruction. So in this case, changing the example caused the probability to change in a positive direction, but like it didn't cause the label to change. So if you can modulate that, how much importance that you're giving to this model or to the example, you can maybe change that. That was my thought.
Okay. Thank you.
There's no other suggestions, then we yeah, sure.
In terms of you can see like which part of the image would activate the most makes the same thing. Like there are they put in this really then
Oh, makes sense. Right.
Yeah, I see a paper that do this kind of thing, but I didn't like look detailedly about this paper, but like we definitely will try it.
So there's a very simple thing, which is my favorite form of this. So this experiment that somebody suggested of withholding some information and putting it back and comparing. Like my favorite form of doing image experiments is the same way, is withhold part of the image. So they take a gray square or a blur or something like that, and blur out or gray out parts of the image, and then see if it changes the assessment. And then you can just make a scan of moving this gray square around to 100 different positions, you run 100 times, and you get a nice feedback of which parts of the image change when you tell them. And so that's I found but that's my like that's been done a bunch, and it's my favorite form of this experiment. For a single image is pretty cool. Yeah, I like this. It's good. I think that for all of us, you know, the mode that I want you all to be in is like, okay, we're doing stuff. All right, we got to put some slides together, show everybody we're doing stuff. But like the real question, the real assignment is to be thinking about what like what's interesting here, what's feasible, like what, like, how can we turn this into a question that people would want to know about, that like that I could go to NeurIPS and I could show people that there's a thing, there's a story. Yes.
Nothing, I was just doing that.
Oh, you're going like, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. next team. Who's the next team? Who do we have next, Miguel? Which team?
Mapping.
Is there not a team here?
Yes.
Okay, let's see.
Yeah. Oh, you're probably not. That's
okay. Okay, thank you very much.
I'll present this stuff. Sorry, are you presenting? Okay,
no, my speech.
Oh, perfect. Hi, we are a team that works with the navigation and how LLMs, or whether they can at all, navigate in the cities. So for our project, or for our during this week, we actually figured out that a lot of works that study LLMs and navigation actually fine-tune them with some data sets. So we were wondering whether the non-fine-tuned LLMs can actually do some kind of navigation. And if that's true, can we then manipulate or kind of steer models somewhere? And what we actually have done, we played with this toy example where we had a grid and we specified how the LLM can navigate it, what moves it can do, where's the beginning and where's the end. And the motivation for that was, well, can LLMs actually give us accurate directions in this grid? And the short answer is yes.
Wait, so what did you put on it? Oh, it's just 0, 1, 1, 2.
Yeah.
Okay, just regular
yes.
coordinates.
Yeah, I will show the instruction. This is the instruction that we provided to LLM later. Yeah, so the answer to the first question is that Llama and Gwen, and I think we tested Gemma, did we? And Gemma, they were quite good at giving locations or navigating this grid. And what we did next is that we wanted to see whether we can steer the model into hallucinating and or providing only left direction or right direction, or whether we can flip the way how the model gives us directions from, for example, saying north to saying up. And why we wanted to do that is because we wanted to know whether there is something inside of the model that actually controls or keeps track of directions and accuracy of paths. And we split this idea into two tasks. So in first task, we asked our model to provide directions by using north, south, east, west. And in the second setting, we asked the model to give the egocentric directions by saying up, down, left, right. And here you can see the instruction that we fed to our model. So we specified how the grid system works, where different cells are and how they are called. And then we sort of asked the model to either give us the cardinal directions or egocentric directions. And we can see that Llama at least is kind of half perfect performance on both of those tasks. And here is a bit about our experimental setup. So we use Llama 3.1 model, which is Instruct fine-tuned, and also Gemma. And I think Gwen. Did we use Gwen? No, we didn't use Gwen. Okay, then it was just Gemma. And we use the Neuronpedia to sort of evaluate and see whether there are features that we can use to steer model into different directions. We split sort of our data into two main categories, where the instructions would be really easy. It would be really easy to get from 0.0 to 0.2, because you just need to say go up twice. And then we also tested a bit more harder examples, where the model had to actually do turns and sort of not just one single direction. And the results.
Maybe you go first and.
Okay. Yes. So the results for the egocentric directions is where we are asking the model to give us coordinates with up, down, left, right. So actually, in many cases, when we just asked it to give a set of egocentric directions, it refused to do so. So we modified our problem.
What's so dangerous about this?
I have no idea. No, I don't know. It just said, usually it would say, "You didn't give me directions, so I will stop here." So we had to rephrase it into, "You should give me a path using up, down, left, right." And then it kind of gave us the perfect performance. So we found a couple of features that correspond to this egocentric words. So, for example, there is this feature which spikes on words like direction, left, right, up, down. And we tried to see what would happen if we sort of amplify this feature. And it seems that initially it would give us, so this here, you can see what would happen initially if we didn't modify the activation. It would give us a correct answer, just go twice up. And if we played around with this one, we see that it actually, if we amplify it, it gives us completely different directions. So it reverses on this simple task here. Similarly, if we did it for a slightly harder task where you had to actually say right, up, up, we could see that it completely disrupted the reasoning. It just gave some kind of nonsense directions. If you follow them, you don't end up at 2-2. Or yeah, so it instead it kind of send us down, right, and then it send us up again and again, right. So somehow this feature is also correlated or connected to its ability to navigate, at least for Llama 3.1 model. We also played with a different neuron. This one specifically activates for left. In any context, it can be also can be not a direction. It was the name of a book or something, and we could see that it also disrupts sort of the way how the model navigates. It gives you a set of it first of all gives too many directions, and then it kind of reverses and goes back and forth. And it also inserts the word left way too much in every like left, middle, top left. So we think this specific feature was maybe correlated or associated with just word left appearing in the prompt, because it's just kept doing that again and again, and it doesn't. Yeah, so that's one of the findings. We also did the experiment where we removed the activation of this neuron, and the model just stopped mentioning left at all. So it tried to get to destination, but I guess it got stuck trying to figure out how to get there without naming left. Finally, what we tried to do is we tried to see whether we can substitute left with east. So we found one feature which corresponds to left. We put it way down, and then we amplified the feature for east. And actually, in many cases, it would start sort of using the egocentric coordinates to navigate the grid, but then it would suddenly just start saying the cordinal directions to provide the directions along this grid. And usually they wouldn't be really accurate. In many cases, if we like push this too much, for example, here we pushed east feature too much, it would start to just kind of give gibberish. It would mention west and east quite a bit. I'm not sure if it's, you can see that it would also mention coast quite a bit of times. So yeah. And this interventions only work for this left, right, up, down. So if we looked at features that are associated with navigation or direction, actually nothing happened to the prompt. It still gave us quite accurate directions. Yes. So the insights from this experiment is that, well, Llama does, first of all, it can produce directions, and it seems that there are some specific features that sort of are helping it to navigate when we steering them. It's somehow the navigation goes like becomes incorrect. Yes, and we also the final here, the final finding is that usually the interventions on the deeper layers would be more efficient. So if we found a feature that associated with up on the earlier layers, it usually didn't really do much.
Okay, sure. I'm gonna also introduce some like exploring results, but with the cardinal directions, which means we will specifically asking the model to output the set of directions which are north, south, west, or east. It's too small, might be. So first, I first try is to manipulate a set of features that are related to north. Let me try to amplify a little bit, but still, yeah, but maybe I will just read it. So I find some features that are associated with the north feature, and the task I input to the model is from 0 to 0 2. So the model is supposed to output north twice. And I just zero these features, and the model still doing good job here. So after steering, the model still output north, although it output 3 times for some reason. For the default model, they also do the same thing. But if you make the negative, for example, the -1 for the same set of the features, I made then -1, and the model starts guessing, okay, there's some noises, so they are guessing east, but still there's some north exist. And once you push this to like even more negative, for example, -2, on the right hand side, the model, the steering one, they said the text is not related, so the model basically refused to answer this question. Yeah, maybe I'll skip over this. I also tried the concept of south, and the phenomenon is similar, but I'll show them like insights here. So one thing I find is if you only control, let's say, one feature of the model, they can still perform this task quite well. So I started to try, okay, I find 3 features in this model and trying to like steering it a little bit. Then we can see some like different phenomena between the 2 default models and the steering one. So I feel like, and this gives us some insights about that. It's a collective set of features that can be effective. It's not a single one that control this like concept up and down something. And also give the situation I negative those features, the model just didn't perform the navigation tasks. So it's probably not only about the cardinal direction concepts, but they also relate to or associated with some navigation tasks. Once you negative, then they just do not willing to do that, the tasks. That's pretty much what I have here.
You want to answer?
Oh, you guys don't have one unified presentation. You have five presentations.
Oh, no. It's just
Okay.
that's
Okay.
yeah.
Is
just we've branched out our
yeah.
research into multiple
Okay.
ways.
Do you have any more presentations to give?
No.
Yeah, that's fine.
Oh, is that okay? Okay. Yeah, that's
Good.
okay.
Yeah, basically just two settings.
Great. I just wanted you guys to have get back from everybody so that you can understand. So yeah, what suggestions to build for the team?
Have you thought about looking at directional efficiency, like if it has a concept of saying the most efficient route? Because you just did a like 3x3 grid, so there's really only four. But if you did a different size grid, you could take a look at it. But it's always choosing the fastest way, or if it has a preference maybe towards going left or right or whatever first, or that kind of.
Yeah, I did see that actually in one of my like results where when I my what I was trying to see was can I eliminate the left direction? So when I tried to do it like with the normal setting, the more I think in both settings it chose different ways to do it. The left direction didn't get eliminated, but in this in one case it went like all like if you open up the grid just search.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, actually maybe this is fine. In one, it had to go from 20 to 00. It had just simply gone here. It ended up going here.
Oh.
And another thing, it initially tried to avoid going left, which is why it went like this. And the other thing, when it had an option to go to left, it went here and then just.
Interesting.
And then another thing that I noticed, again, this was like maybe a hallucination. It forgot the concept. When I tried to remove left, it forgot the concept of up. So it went from bottom row to top row, that was going down. And from zero to here, it was also going down. So that, and then this was without steering as well in the normal case. So that was something.
Nice. Nice.
Can I ask for this? Do you like specifically tell it to take the most efficient route and prompt it?
No, we just get, I think this is the problem. We just ask it to give us a step.
Can we actually pick 3x3 so that there is at least a few alternative routes? Because in 2x2, there would be only one way.
Right.
So.
But at every instance that I generated, I kept the temperature zero so that it would generate the most deterministic response. And I prompted this case twice. It gave me the same log round.
Nice. More ideas? More suggestions?
Yeah, for now it's like a two-dimensional thing. Do you have plan to expand this to three-dimensional?
Yes.
Yeah, ideally, we want to put it in the real world, the urban situation. But yeah, let's see.
Like landscape, no grid, and there's just so much hallucination that, like, even
That's
for Northeastern to Boston Commons, it'll go to MFA.
Sorry
Stuff
for
like
your simplification. It's nice. I like it. You really simplify it down. Nice. What suggestion do you have?
Oh, yeah. So I'm encouraged to look at using intermediate visualization representations of your space. So I forgot the name of the paper was. I think the framework is VOT or something like that. But basically, they explored a similar like 3x3 griddle problem, Joe Hans griddle problems. They found out was that there's a lot of visual tiling style setups that LLMs are specifically not good with, other kinds of visualizations. But they found out that applying like remedial tracking or some remedial to some intermediate level tools really helped carry it. So that might like qualitatively categorically change the reasonings.
Cool. So can I ask you to help me by finding that thing and maybe mail it to them or send it on Discord or something?
I have the paper with me.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, thank
Thanks.
you so much.
Thanks. I like this. I like the way you guys simplified it down. You started with a very broad, vicious thing, and you're like, okay, well, we'll look at this simple thing. It's good to keep your ambitions in mind, but I think it's nice. And a lot of
Actually,
you guys.
it came out when we started experimenting with big problems. So we did try with our
Yeah.
goal, and we thought that it starts hallucinating a lot.
Yeah.
So that we kind of nailed it down to something which is much more simpler, and we saw that, okay,
I think it's good.
something that does not hallucinate,
Yeah,
we experiment.
and you can see that it allowed you to do a lot of experiments already and make very really fast progress by making really simple thing. I guess
The paper's called Mind's Eye of LLMs Visualization.
And who's the other?
Wenxuan Wu.
Wenxuan Wu, Mind's Eye. Yeah,
It is.
But
It's already there.
in your setting are so most of the interventions you're doing has to do with like what's the output of the model? A model's an output and what an output is, right? I'm interested in if the model is thinking about things that are not learn from the output. Does the model know where it is? Does it know what its goal is? Does it know how close it is to the goal? Does it know what it's been in progress? Mm. If you frustrate the model, so like you're on a 3x3 grid, maybe it's not very discernible and the model's chasing the goal. And you can add, so some of the suggestions were, oh, can you make this harder in some way? Well, if you make it harder in certain ways, you might be able to set up obstacles or set up alternate paths that if you follow that allow you to have more experimental questions that you can ask. So I think that that's a reasonable first thing to be doing right now to see how far with the models you have accessible to you, how complex you can get the setup to work, where you can actually do things. Like you say, when you make a tuple class, it's all hallucinations. You lose the ability to do experiments. But maybe that's a reasonable question now, because there's a lot of other questions that you could ask if it's a little bit more complicated. Like, does the model know where it is? Does the model know that something's stopping it, or is in a way that it has to try again, or how close it is? Or does the model get frustrated? You know, like a kind of funny question that don't have to deal with it directly north and south, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm interested in that kind of thing. But I think you guys are doing great. Now, we're probably running too short on time to not let another team
come out.
Present, is that right? So we can do the same thing. How many teams do we have left? What are the teams left? So we can do the same thing. We can have you guys, or are there teams that really want to share it now? We can make kind of this. Do you want to share something now? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to have your team share right now?
I don't want to hold people.
Yeah, we kind of have a lot.
Are we done with the time?
Yeah, we're good.
Oh, we're done. Okay, so we're done. Okay, so I said, you have to tell me. Like, I have no idea. Okay, so, okay, this night. Okay,
yeah.
We're done. So we'll start next time with the remaining people. And then we'll talk a little bit about, I think the topic is, I think the topic is about how to do larger scale data collection. We'll talk a little bit more about
it.
Have a meeting.
All right,
okay, sure.
Okay, so you want the team?
So,